that we happen. Now, I want to come back to what we did at the last week's shir, when we spoke about Yiddish, the whole question of Yiddish, which you can all understand. It's a new culture, a new language. How many people, my mother-in-law, Zichrona Tzadeket Levracha, really a great woman. Like all kind, you know, you don't appreciate your mother-in-law when you're young, but then you learn to understand who this lady was. So here's a lady who was born in America in 1906, I believe it was. Born in America, her grandparents lived in America already. And she remained firm, and she always would say her greatest moment of embarrassment was in public school. There were no schools for girls yet, no yeshiva. That comes after World War II, basically. But she was in public school in Brooklyn, and she used the word kalenda instead of calendar. You follow? In Yiddish, vizat min a kalenda. No, a kalenda in English is calendar, but you see it spelled. You pronounce it a calendar, and you can understand already that little story captures an era. In the state of Israel, none of us are embarrassed to make a mistake in Hebrew. I don't believe any of us still got it right with Zachar Nekeva, with the counting. Americans, the French get it right away because they, in their language, you have that. But no one gets embarrassed there. I've heard the biggest American rabbis who integrated on the Israeli scene, and when they would speak, they were totally mixed up with Echad, with Echad, with Shnayim, etc. But no one will correct us. You know why? Because this is a country of immigrants. America was not a country of immigrants. You were a greenhorn. You follow, you wanted to become part of the scene. So language remains a problem. Now, I did mention that in Lakewood, and I said it, you know, both, I would say, semi-seriously, that Freddie Zucker, Zichrono Livracha, anyone from Baltimore may recognize the name. He died young, but Freddie Zucker convinced me that the Ribbono Shel Olam gave the Torah in Yiddish. So Professor Tarrigan gave me a sheet that I want to comment on. What is the sheet? If I understood Morty correctly, Chassidim, which is in Shari Chesed. Shari Chesed today has brought great shame to the Jewish people, but that's a different story. Well, no, the problem is that anyone with a beard, if you see TV, they identify, if you're wearing black and you have a beard, you're a Haredi, they're spitting in your face. The Haredim can be the finest people in the world. What do you want out of them? And many of them serve in the army. And if they don't, right now the law of the land is that if you're learning Torah full time, you don't have to serve in the army. What do you want out of them? But everyone sees black, they react right away. Like after Rabin was killed, which was a terrible, terrible thing. So anyone with a kippah srugah, they spotted you. You walked in the street, you're a murderer. I was called a rotseach. I was in a cab coming from the airport with a whole, and I couldn't, and the kid, the grandson and the father were wearing kippah, and the grandmother, she saw the kippah srugah, she was ready to kill me. So it's a problem. Anyway, so in Kal Chassidim, they try not to say tachnun every day. And Mori says that the other day, Yartzeit, Chav Chet Tishrei, they give out a sheet on who's Yartzeit. It was Rebbe Shmuel Landau, the Av Beit Din of Prague, the son of the Nodabi Yehuda. So now I want to ask you for, they give out these sheets every day?
Every day.
To come up with a sheet like this takes five times as much as Challel on Monday, Thursday.
They give them every year the same sheet.
Oh, every year. Say whoever, you follow me, Yosef? It's unbelievable. So they come up with the sheet, and here they give a biography, and I know a little bit about Rav Shmuel Landau, and he's arguing, and he's writing, and he's fighting, and ubeloshen hazenit lanu toratenu hakadosha umitzvot Hashem, that in Hebrew, the Torah was given to us, and the mitzvot were given to us, and Morty said, this is a proof against Freddie Zucker. Gentlemen, excuse me? The Baruch Hashem, it's a nice sheet. It's
no, but for Yom
I hear what you're saying. So on Yom HaTzvot, it's a... they say on Yom Ha'atzmaut and they say a long time, whatever, I don't want to get involved in politics, but I just want to explain to you that this does not refute Freddy Zucker. I'll tell you why. You have to know Torah history. What he's writing here is not against Yiddish. He is fighting a bitter battle against the Reform movement. By the 1840s, they have come out of Germany, they're in Austro-Hungary, and one of their biggest innovations was changing the prayer service to German, to the vernacular. So if you see what he's debating and what he's writing, it's against changing. No one will know Hebrew. And we see what happened once you lose that connection. You lose the connection. L'chol ha-Torah kula takes a generation or two. I don't have to elaborate. Hashem Yerachim. So I have to say, this does not defeat Freddy Zucker. We can defeat him other ways, but not for the knockout from the Noda Behuda's son. Then I want to show you something very fascinating. This is a volume that just came out. Mishkanotecha Yisrael, Rav Yisrael Porat. Anyone recognize the name? Anyone here from Cleveland? Okay, Rav Yisrael Porat. I have to be very brief, but I want to just show you something very interesting. First of all of us have met his descendants. Porats are all over the place. He was Zeuche, he came to America right after World War I, and he was Zeuche to have, I would imagine, hundreds and hundreds of grandchildren, great-grandchildren, Shomrei Torah Mitzvot, a very strong majority living on Admat HaKodesh. The Sparrow family ties in with Rav Porat. In other words, it comes from the daughters, the sons, the daughters. Amazing how the family remained from. I taught many members of the family. You'll come up with the name right here in Yerushalayim. Okay. Story of his life. They just put out the Sefer dealing with his life and manuscripts that remain. They tell me now they're translating it into English. So I started going through it. I find it very fascinating. Let me clue you in. He comes to New York in 1923, and he was born in Yerushalayim, in the Yishuv HaYashan. He was friendly with Rabbi Yehoshua Leib Diskin, the Brisker Rav. You don't have to get any more narrow-minded. Rabbi Yehoshua Leib Diskin, as I told you more than once, he was the one who authored the Cherem. You're not allowed to learn any other language outside of Lashon HaKodesh and Yiddish. Outside of those two languages, you cannot learn any other language, French and English, Arabic he was even opposed. Why? Because of assimilation. If you learn the language, you can assimilate. You should know, the old time Eidah Haredit will not teach their kids English, even though many of them speak English beautifully because they needed to raise money to go across the world, etc. But they don't learn it formally. It all goes back to the Chaim of Rav Diskin. He was friendly with Rav Diskin. He was friendly with Joseph Chaim Sonnenfeld, okay? The Eidah Haredit. He also was a Talmud of Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk. So he was a fascinating individual. The Eidah Haredit sent him overseas, or what today's the Eidah Haredit, Yishuv HaYashan, to raise money after World War I. There was Germany, money stopped coming from Germany. To a certain degree, money stopped coming from Europe. So they sent them to raise money in the countries that still were alive and kicking. He winds up in Manchester, England. He's there for 2 years, I believe. And from Manchester, he was a Rav in Manchester. From Manchester, he comes to the United States. 1923, comes to the States. He's Rav in Plainfield, New Jersey. Now, Plainfield had East European immigrants. You got to remember that people were moving out of New York. People were moving out of Newark. He was caught up there in a big struggle. They wanted to go conservative. They probably did ultimately. But he struggled with them to keep an Orthodox sitter. But he was not evidently the happiest person in the world there. 1925, there was a Mizrahi convention in Cleveland. And he goes to the Mizrahi convention. While he's in Cleveland, there's a shul that Ohev Tzedek, that has been without a rabbi already 2 years. And they hear this rabbi came and he already was in Manchester. In other words, he was polished. He's not just coming out of the ghetto of the Yeshiva Yashan, but he was in Manchester. Well, they're looking for a rabbi and they invite him. And I have to tell you the Hebrew. I never knew this Hebrew. Lavo l'shabbat hitrashmut. What do we call that? A praba. A praba. I don't know if there's an English word, a tryout, but the tryout doesn't, it's the klimtziklish, that doesn't ring home. A praba. So, in modern Hebrew, I can't believe this. Shabbat hitrashmut. You know what that means, though? Hitrashmut? Like, how the people are impressed by you, the rishum you leave, the impression. Okay? So he comes, and they're overwhelmed. Friday night, he gives a drasha in perfect English. Shabbos morning, a drasha in Yiddish. And in addition, he leads a junior service for the children. They hire him on the spot, and he remains there for many years. Now, here you, it's, all right, it's the 1920s, it's 20 years later. But it's a picture. It captures where we're at, the difficulty of language. And let me say to Rabbi Peratt's credit, believe it or not, and I heard this years ago from a member of the family, but here it is in print, that originally when he gave an English drasha, he wrote it out in Hebrew letters. You follow? He, like, what do we have? The Kaddish, the old-time Siddurim, when you opened up and back, they had Kaddish and Kaddish Rabbanan, transliteration. Yiskadal, the Yiskadash, right? In English. Today's generation, Yosef never saw it, take my word for it. But in today's generation, all right, thank God, we don't need it. Or maybe we do need it, but those people don't come into shul. But imagine he wrote the drasha out in English letters and was able to give it in English. So he remains a very fascinating individual. I have to tell you, he was a very big Talmud Chacham. And before he left Israel, he went to see, you got to remember after World War I, a lot of people left Yerushalayim, Talmid Chachamim. Some of us studied with them afterwards. For instance, Rabbi Mirsky, Shmuel Kalman Mirsky, Yerushalmi. Rabbi Dr. Rasha Ziv. Did you study with Rabbi Ziv?
His son was in your class.
So you know what a big Talmud Chacham he was. He put out Tshuva Tarama. A wonderful, wonderful individual. Bnei Akiva met in his shul in the Bronx, Kehilat Israel. He was a pulpit rabbi, a Talmud Chacham, a wonderful doctorate, and afterwards he wrote on the Ramah, a lot of skuyat. So he had two boy sons, as I recall, in the yeshiva. So you say, you remember his name?
Yes.
Where does he live today? I know one son, I believe, is in Tinek, if I'm not mistaken. All right, anyway, they all left. The Shulson family arrives in Philadelphia. You can go one by one. A whole slew of people left. They were starving. They were pashut starving. The Mann family. I mean, that's another example. Rabbi Danny Mann. He teaches in the Kollel. Eretz Chemda. His grandparents left at that time. In Yeshiva, there were two Manns. Excuse me?
He was in Quincy, Mass.
Right, that's his grandfather.
And every day he brought his sons to my mother.
Right, that's his grandfather. That is correct. So they all left. So before he left, he went to get a bracha from Rav Kook. So Rav Kook told him, look, there's a real problem teaching Gemara. It's not organized. What are we doing? By the way, this problem exists until today, and there are conventions on it, and mechanchim, and people talk about it. And it's not, in Israel, if you notice what's going on now with the Talmud for children, the Daf Yomi for children, you know what I'm talking about? It's fabulous, fabulous. A young kid, you can turn him on, you can get him excited. But it's really a problem with Gemara. I write about it in Washington. In my time, how did I get turned on? I mean, I was a kid, I was in fifth grade in Salanta. So our teacher, Mr. Perach, he hebraized his name. I think the original was something like Peacock. And it became a Hebrew name, Perach. And he was a Hebraist, he was a Zionist, he was that generation that it's hard for you to conceive. But not a Shema Shabbos. These people, and all the day schools, I'll talk about it when I'm in the Hakarat HaTova Sheyurim. All the day schools, these were the teachers. They loved children, they loved to teach. He was a wonderful teacher. So when we started Gemara, Eilu Mitzvah, Chayav Lahachra, there's no an American kid is interested, Eilu Mitzvah, but Abaye and Rava, he said, I'll never forget this, he says to us, it's like Joe Volcock versus Joe Lewis. Round one to Abaye, round two to Rava. So the kid, I got all excited, you know, who couldn't get excited? Joe Lewis, ain't clean a kite. All right. And I from that moment on, I loved Gemara. And if you have a proper Rebbe, you can excite. I mean, I showed yesterday with the question of your life or your wallet or your life, you can write a whole master's thesis on the halachic implications. We showed so many different studies where this comes to life, where you're building a wall around the city. How do you pay? You pay a progressive tax or a head tax? What's the wall being built for, et cetera, et cetera. And it's amazing that he's showing him already, Tosfos is already analyzing it, like he's living in Brooklyn and dealing with holdups. So Rav Kook said to the young Rav Parat, you should write a mavol to the Gemara. And you should know, he devoted his life, many mesechtot, you have mavol, it's by, this is the Rav Yisrael Parat, who wrote in beautiful Hebrew. He was actually, his native language was Hebrew, Hebrew Yiddish. He knew Arabic, that he had to learn because as working for the Edah Haredit, he had to deal with Arabs. And then afterwards, he knew English and mastered it. It was totally at home. Later in life, he didn't have to write English and Hebrew letters. So this problem of language, it's an inevitable problem that lives on until today. And each one has their own prejudice. The truth is, there's a certain passion to life. When Chazal say, Fuk chazi mai amad dava, go and see what the people are doing on the outside, or lo neviim heim, b'nei neviim heim, what Chazal are really telling us, that ultimately the pulse of life will determine which way to go. And there's no question in my mind, if you're teaching Torah in America, you have to teach in English. You can't teach in Yiddish. Even the Rav had to give in 1960. On the other hand, remember, without Hebrew today, you're cutting the kid off from the state of Israel. And you can see it right here in the Kollel, the difficulty the students have when there's no Schottenstein. How many times I've been asked if there's an English translation. And it's very important from a young age on, a youngster should feel at a home in Hebrew. It opens up a whole world. I understand. But once you have Hebrew, you have it's almost the key to Aramaic. I always thought about that when I saw my grandchildren starting to learn Gemara. They're fluent like any kid growing up here. Their native language is Hebrew. But they made the transition to Gemara, to Aramaic, very easily. It was not a difficult translation.
Did anybody ever think of teaching a class in Aramaic to students?
I would imagine in the high schools they have classes in Aramaic. I would imagine. I can't imagine in the religious high schools. I'm positive there's Arabic being taught for different reasons, that we have to be at peace with the Arabs, we have to know their language. All right, there's truth to that. It doesn't hurt to know Arabic. If you live in Haifa, one thing I can tell you, I would imagine half the bus drivers are Arabs, if not more. Whenever I get on a bus in Haifa, you can hear the accent, you see what they look like. But there, they're totally integrated. It's not like the Jerusalem Arabs, where you can feel a certain sense of enmity. We hate being here, we're upset that we're here, you don't belong here. The Arabs in Haifa evidently have lived with the Jews so many crucial years that they're basically totally integrated. But there are other reasons for teaching Aramaic, to know Gemara, to know Midrash. I'm sure there are classes like that. But Hebrew is the basis, and it's also our union. Everything that the Reb Shmuel Landau was talking about, it's the union of Jews. It's the, you know, when they have when the rabbis in Europe meet, they speak English. That becomes the language. That gives us a message that most of those rabbis are not at home in Hebrew. Okay, anyway, this question lives on, and I think English has won out in the Anglo world. It's inevitable that it should win out, just as Hebrew and speaking in Sfardit, and I see many of the youngsters daven Nusach Sfard here, including my own grandchildren, so it shows you there's a certain pulse to Jewish living that determines some basic factors of our existence. Don't misunderstand me, everything's in consonance with Halacha. It's no great crime if an Ashkenaz daven Sfard or a Sfard daven Ashkenaz, but there's a certain pulse to life. Okay. So this was one of the real problems they attempted to deal with, and you see that even in 1902 they were willing to say, if you see the children understand it better in English, speak English. Then of course you need people who are at home in English who can speak English, but this is the reality. What's most important to us is that a young person should be a Shoma Torah Mitzvah, whatever language he gains it in, is very secondary. Okay, then the next issue they deal with, and this is something we alluded to with the Rav, and it's so interesting the way they verbalize it here, but they're dealing with the issue that the kids go to cheder, and their bar mitzvah is the end of their education. What do we do about that? And here he says, yes, we have to face reality. I'm paraphrasing. The kids are going to finish with their bar mitzvah. They go on to high school. Now, high school is a very decisive part of our education. When we look back and ask ourselves, what influenced this? Why are we what had such hashpa'a on what we are today, there's no question high school is dominant. High school is dominant because, number one, you're at the age, you're blossoming, you're becoming mature, you're becoming an adult, and you are open. You're not set in your ways. And high school career, you become serious for the first time. No one has to plead with you to study. You recognize in a few years, I have to make a living. What do I want to do? So they recognize that kids going to high school are very busy, are caught up with their studies. But here they call upon, we have to develop evening classes, what I would call extension education for young people, so that Torah, Divrei Elokim Chayim, and look what they write here, V'lo yishkach mipihem l'chol ha'pachot et asher lamdu b'yaldutam, that at least they should remember the Chumash, the Mishnah, what they learned in their youth, Shabbat, Kashrut, Tarat Mishpacha. Look what you're dealing with, just think what America was like. And we must see to it that there's an extension of their education. But look at the next words. And what is so important? Al yedei no'amim tovim l'naharei b'nei Yisrael. Now, to translate it literally, you think of looking for rabbis. Today, you're looking for a rabbi. He has to be able to speak. Rabbi Parad spoke English, Hebrew. He got the rabbinate, English, Yiddish, I should say. He got the rabbinate. Noamim. We would use the words today in modern Hebrew, mechanchim tovim. But you see, they recognize, pedagogues. But they recognized already then that you need teachers who can speak the language. And this, of course, explains the Rebbe's position and the Lubavitcher Rebbe's position. I can tell you, I never asked permission to go on Aliyah. If I would have gone to the Rav and asked him, Rebbe, I want to go on Aliyah, the Rav would have said, for you, it's not permissible. You grew up here, you know the language, you teach the youngsters, they love your shayurim. You can't leave. And I can tell you, the Rav was not happy with anyone going on Aliyah that was succeeding in America. Give me a little classic name. that everyone knows about, Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, of course. Here, the great Reb Aaron, going in Aliyah, the Rebbe wasn't happy. I know people, where's the Lubavitcher Rebbe? There was a Rabbi Green in Hamilton, wonderful, wonderful rabbi. He was in yeshiva, a little older than I am. He learned with Isaacs. Isaacs and Green were chavruta. So he went to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, all excited, he's ready to go on Aliyah, and the Rebbe told him, absolutely not. You're succeeding, and the Jews need you where you are. You know the language.
He really did succeed.
And I know him. I know what I'm talking about. A little guy, remember? A dynamo, an absolute dynamo. There's a Donnie Cohn in Stamford, Connecticut, my Talmud. Donnie Cohn is, I don't think he's more than 5'3", right or wrong. A little guy, 5'4", maybe. Kabbalah Shabbos, Lechun Aranenol, Lechad Dodi. He has hundreds of people, Balabatim, Stamford, Connecticut, not Sadiqi Hadar, not Hasidi Hadar, dancing. I couldn't believe the whole shul alive, dancing, spirit. Green was like that, unbelievable kind of individual. And he didn't go in Aliyah because of the Rebbe. There were others, I can tell you, you read the Lubavitch, they interview people. There was the Peter Kalms, he was one of the key Balabatim in London. I taught his daughter. He was very close to the Rebbe. And you're talking about a British gentleman, integrated, a businessman. And he was all excited. He's going to go to Kamen Aliyah to Israel. I don't think his wife was too excited. And they all asked the Rebbe, and he was absolutely confident the Rebbe would tell him to go. You know, he walked out of the office, told his wife, you're right. I think they're in the office together with the Rebbe. All right, this is the same thing with Russia. It wasn't easy. Some of the people in Russia who were doing fabulous work for Chabad, the Rebbe told them not to leave. And this is reality. Look, I'm a great Zionist. I hold everyone in the world should be here. But I have to say, I understand the Rebbe. I understand the Rebbe. And this is so important, to be able to speak the language, to integrate. And this is the challenge when you come in Aliyah. I can tell you on my own personal level, right or wrong, when I first arrived here, 69, a Talmud of the Rav, I knew Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen, Cook's Psak, I tried to continue to daven in Ashkenazis. And Friday night I would make Kiddush, Baruch Atah, I can barely say it today, and my children laughed at me. And I made a decision. I remember that Friday night at the Kolto, it was unbelievable. You can't imagine what was going on. It was still the aura of the Six-Day War. So at the Kolto Friday night, there was Rav Gorin with the Makelah HaRabbanit HaTzvait. Later, I used to perform with them in the army. I would lecture, then they would follow up with a show. And it was like magic, voices, angels. So I went over to Rav Gorin and I told him, I'm a Talmud of the Rav. I was at the shiur you gave a few years ago. You know, the famous shiur when Rav Gorin visited America. It's not for now, but it became a whole course celebre. We look at Rav Heschel Schechter. There's a lot to talk about, a lot that you can say and a lot that you don't want to say. But a course celebre. But I asked Rav Gorin, and he also knew me because I was working on the article on him for the Encyclopedia Judaica, 69, 70, 71. I'm working at the Judaica. I'm a staff editor. They brought me in Aliyah. So he knew me. And I said to him, Kvot Harav, ani gadalti bashkenazis, mutali lachlif et hamiftah. Oh, he brought me proof after proof. By the time I walked away, I believed that Rashi davened in Sfardit, not just Rav Gorin. So you see, that this is, it's the nuance here. And thank God I switched, because thank God my children turned out to wonderful. But I don't know, had I not switched, and they're laughing at me, lo na'im. Okay, now, I just want to add on a postscript. I used the word extension education. Is that the right word to use? What do we mean by extension education? Today when we use that word, we mean adult extension education. You're not going to call a high school extension education. A kid goes to yeshiva, goes to elementary school, he has to continue. But adult extension education. in all the shuls in America, and I remember this fondly, the Rabbanim were always trying to teach. Can anyone tell me which sefer became dominant in every shul that had Judeo-Persian influenced East European immigrants across the United States? Morty, you hit the nail on the head. Today, Yosef, do you know what the Ein Yaakov is?
That
kol hakavod, the agadata of Shas. That alabalabatim was sitting and learning Ein Yaakov with the rabbi. Now, why Ein Yaakov? See, Ein Yaakov had one advantage. People came. When did the Rebbe teach? Tzvi Shemitchan Marav. Tzvi Shemitchan Marav, a guy finished a hard day at work. These people worked hard. Nowadays, they worked hard. Today, you'll get medical doctors. No, they dealt with life and death. Now, they're 8 to 9 at night, 7 to 8 at night. How could you concentrate on Gemara? I told you I'm learning Yevamot. Baruch Hashem, I'm now in the situation, the Gemara with Geirut. I'm past the initial challenge. Oh, it's like baby stuff to me. I'm flying. Do you understand? This is normal. This, I don't have to have a 3D mind. I just have to have a halachic mind. But who can concentrate? Oh, but Ein Yaakov and the stories and the tales. And the Rabbanim were always trying, and kol hakavod. Now, formal extension education, that's the Young Israel movement. And you have to give credit to the Young Israel. No one has ever done a definitive volume on how the Young Israel began. And I just take out a minute, because many of you don't realize it, the Young Israel is a shoot-off of the seminary, JTS. Vic, you know, because of your great uncle, right? But most people, they hear, whenever you read the memoir literature today, like I'm reading a volume Adina Katzoff put out, a volume that solves my problems on Rabbi Belkin, and I cry that I don't have any student interested. Here, look in the kolel, look how much interest there is in Jewish history and Torah history. And one kid in the kolel came to me, he wants to write on the Netziv. I think he told me, no, on the Aruch HaShulchan, I'm confusing myself with the Netziv. I wanted to write on the Netziv. But he wants to write the Aruch HaShulchan. I tried to tell him a little bit about Rabbi Belkin, and I told him I can help you. And now in this volume, I really can help. But I call Korei Bamidba, and it hurts. Shmuel Belkin deserves.
Maybe one of the virtual students.
Maybe one of the virtual students is listening. And I can't go into more detail, but if you'll contact me, I'll explain what I mean, this father. Do any of you know she's still alive? She's 102 today.
Very nice,
but she's not that well anymore, Alzheimer's, but a wonderful lady. The seminary was her home. Her husband was a graduate. Her friends were all seminary people. Her sister married a seminary graduate, a Yiddish tzaddik, Rav Avram Goldberg, Zeichet Tzaddik Levracha. Well, what is that? Bells from the school yesterday, too. It drove us crazy. Okay. As long as it's not the microphone, right?
No.
Okay. Baruch Hashem. Chatzina Chama. So they went into extension education, the Young Israel. I can tell you later in the 30s, the yeshiva and yeshiva college got involved.
When did the Young Israel start?
Young Israel began during World War I, basically. The early 1912, 1913, maybe we'll talk about it down the line, but 1914, do you remember the exact year? It's that era. And after World War I, in the 20s, they already were talking extension education in the sense that we know it. And then yeshiva and yeshiva college got involved. Then
Israel speak English, was that one?
English. The English, and no talking during davening, and no schnurres. You don't remember what an old-fashioned shul was like? You went in laning, took 20 minutes, and the schnurs took 40 minutes. Every guy, when I get an aliyah, if there's a make a mishaberach, I just say, Malka bat Reb Simcha v'kod yotzei chalutzeh. I still remember, how many of you remember when Balabatim got an aliyah, they listed out every son and every daughter and every son-in-law and every daughter-in-law and every grandchild. Rebbeinu Shel Olam, the laning, and you should know in Maplewood, one of the first things I did, I'm building an Orthodox shul, I abolished the Mishaberachs. Just one Mishaberach klali at the very end. The only time there was an exception, there was one guy in the shul, I don't want to mention the name, but he did leave a family that's partially Shomer Torah Mitzvah, and he was a wealthy guy. His family had come to America right after the Civil War and remained from, and a part of it remained from. And he was a wealthy guy. When he got an aliyah, he looked at the gabbai, Mishaberach. I told the gabbai, for him, you make a Mishaberach, mention the names. Every name you mention is money. Let's have a little cycle here. Chok v'lo yavo, but there have to be exceptions to the laws. But, okay, I just want to say something interesting. Extension education, with the advent of Hitler and World War II, yeshiva already was lost, no extension education. When we went to yeshiva, did you see classes for adults? No, Charlie, when you went, the 60s, right? Did you see classes for adults? I mean, extension education? Absolutely not. Yitzchak, did you see classes in yeshiva? But Boston is a different story.
3 days a week, and they fed the Hebrew college, and the Hebrew college and a summer camp, Yavne, and Ivrit. It was amazing.
No,
and many people came out through.
No, Baruch Hashem, but yeshiva, extension. Today, the last, 15, 20 years, Midreshet Yom Rishon. You know what goes on in YU in Washington Heights? They took over Yeshiva Soloveitchik. Remember Yeshiva Soloveitchik? It's now part of Yeshiva University. They turned it into a theater. You got to see this to believe it. There's no shul there anymore. This is where Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik davened. This is on the way to Breuer's. It's two blocks closer to the Breuer kingdom. And I have to be respectful because they're members of the Breuer family that are virtual students of mine who have donated beautiful donations in my honor to Shvat Ami. So I say Breuer's with awe and respect, even though there's someone from the Breuer community sitting in front of me with a smile on his lips. Anyway, the Soloveitchik Yeshiva, Yom Rishon, classes for men, classes for women, and when there's a famous Noam, to quote the Agudas HaRabbanim, they allow men and women together. And I've spoken there a number of times, hundreds of people coming from all over New York, New Jersey, extension education, I believe the Obersfeld family sponsor said. It is beautiful what yeshiva does today. So I just mentioned this in passing because here they're talking extension education, they're talking about children, about youngsters, teenagers, that they shouldn't forget the Kaddish they were taught in Chaydar. All right, this is the era. This is, no one could believe, who would believe what would subsequently come out of America. But this was the era. You got to put yourself 115 years ago and not look at it with the glasses of today. It's not Teaneck or Renglewood or Lawrence or Oceanside. I mean, you go community by community. Boston, Detroit today, Los Angeles, what a world today.
You know, it's strange to say something nice about reform, but they made a fuss about confirmation. So
okay.
They held their kids till age 16.
If confirmation was at 16, some of them did it at 12 or 13, boys and girls, but all right, reform, I'll accept that compliment. Let me go a step further, and this is an issue that I'm just going to scratch the surface. Over the years, Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll polish it and polish it. Gentlemen, by 1902, there already was a yeshiva in America. That yeshiva was called Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchok Hochanan, and it represented the merger of Eitz Chaim with Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Kalkanen. Dov Eitz Chaim began 1886. I once saw a sweatshirt here. The yeshiva in New York came out with sweatshirts, and it said on it, Reitz 1897. Oh, was I upset. Amei Haaretz, Reitz is not the beginning. Eitz Chaim, 1886. Okay. Yosef, did you know the with difference or not? How old is yeshiva?
Not the years, but I knew the
Got Kanayin Har, Baruch Hashem. Some people have read Rakefet scholarship. I am happy. I am rewarded. Okay. Now, then they merged.
What year was the merger?
The merger basically, officially takes place 1915. But the negotiations and the reasons they have to merge are already on the scene in 1902. Number one, very shortly after Rabbi Yaakov Yosef's demise, an elementary yeshiva is organized named the Rabbi Jacob Joseph School. Once you have the Rabbi Jacob Joseph School, Yitzchak Ochanan starts taking in older kids. Ultimately, it's basically 7th and 8th grade. The elementary part, they're going to RJJ. Reitz is for high school kids who have fathers who take them by the year, and Rabbanim who take their kids by the year, and said, it's not enough that you're going to Stuyvesant High School. We want you to learn Gemara when you're awake, alert. So at 4 o'clock, they were learning Gemara on a serious level. Now, while this is happening, and this is all in the early 1900s, while this is happening, you have the greenhorns coming in. What does it mean, a greenhorn? When I came in Aliyah, we didn't go direct to Israel. We went to a Merkaz Klita. Morty, when you came?
I was a Weissman.
You were a Weissman. Charlie, when you came? No, you were not married. You were whatever.
I was married. I just came to Weissman.
Also to Weissman. Well, when did you study with Professor Katsir? At Weissman. He was at wow. And you know, you were Mavaseret. Okay. So what's the idea of an absorption center? The idea is give you a chance to acclimate. You're not going to be thrown into Israeli society all at once. Plenty of people you can speak English to in the absorption center. And if you need language, you take an ulpan in Hebrew. It was very nice. They semi-supported you, as I recall. I didn't get money because I was working the day they wanted me to go to work. The day after I got here Saturday night. Sunday we were in Yerushalayim. They wanted me to start work Monday. They give me a week to catch my breath. I started work July 12th, 1969 at the encyclopedia. But there are reasons why. They were in a rush to finish. It was now privately owned. So they wanted serious people who could bring it to fruition. So in an absorption center, this is the concept. They don't want to throw you into a society that you don't know when you're totally unprepared for it. We're never going to be total Israelis. We're never going to be totally prepared. We're always going to be Israelis of American origins, Anglo origins. But, Ein Hachinami, there's a tremendous integration between us and the Israeli scene. I'll give you a simple example. When I went into a bank, it was a mob scene. You never knew who was on first. I said to the bank manager, must be early 70s, why don't you institute numbers and everyone will take a number? He looked at me, lo na gimcha chaf echad lo 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 tikach, anachnu lo mevinim, says, Iraq is the yot ba'atzot abrit. Today there isn't a bank where you don't take a number. So it is integration. A lot of the greenhorns came to Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Ochanan because this was an absorption center for them. It's the world they knew. Right? They're coming. What did they do in Europe? Gesitzten gelernt. They sat and learned. They were teenagers. No one went to school. No one went to university. Now they come to America. Wow, there's a place to go to learn. There's shayurim, people to talk and learning with. But within a year, within 2 years, their eyes open and the turmoil begins. We want to succeed in America. We don't want to be poor. We don't want to be looked down upon. We need education. Give us a high school. The pressure is building. And you can read about this in Revel. It ultimately leads to the merger. It leads to my cousin, Rabbi Revel, giving up the oil industry, coming to New York, Rabbi Dr. Bernard Revel, Dov Revel. It leads to your alma mater, my alma mater, MTA, Talmudical Academy. There was then no M because there was no B, no Brooklyn. But the murmur already is beginning in the 1900s. Now, this is very interesting, but very true. Some of the Balabatim who put money into the yeshiva were very opposed. And their attitude was very simple. We give our money that you should sit and learn. Wir sollen sitzen und lernen. We succeeded in America. I make a lot of money. I have a big star. I own property. My English is good enough. I don't need a fancy English. We don't want to contribute to the yeshiva, to reach, for you to go to high school. You have to know, Balabatim were opposed. It was a big struggle. There were strikes. It's like a movie. You could make a movie. If you take Bernard Revel, the volume, and put it into a movie, you have a classic. There were strikes. The yeshiva boys are striking. The Yiddish press had a field day. There were 4 or 5 daily Yiddish papers then. But, what went on? And the Balabatim. And you can understand the Balabatim. I want to give my money. I want to give it where I want to give. I have a right. People will say to me, where to give money? I always tell people, if you have a big donation to give, you want to support a yeshiva, give it to Merkaz Yeshiva B'nai Akiva. So they look at it. I said, I'm no different than the Rav. I can tell you a story. Permit me to tell it to you. I know the story for many decades, but Tovis said, don't say. Now it's time. It should be said in public. In the 70s, the president of Israel, Zalman Shazar, established the prize from Chaneichin de Golah, who does for Yiddishkeit. The Rav was awarded the prize. Rav Aaron and Tover, their family members, went to the president's home, had a little sudan, presented a check. I don't know what the check was, 25,000 lira, let's say. I don't remember. So they didn't know what to do with the check. So they called the Rav, and they tell the Rav, Tata, you know, we have this check. What should we do with us? What do we do with it? They spoke Yiddish. The Rav's children spoke Yiddish then. That was their language. So the Rav says, you'll take the check, endorse my name, and sign it over to Merkaz Yeshivat B'nai Akiva. And that's where the check went. So, you can understand a person wants to give where he wants to give. I understand that 100%. I'm not putting anyone else down, but I want my money to go where it represents my ultimate belief, my ultimate commitment. Big machlokes. Interestingly, among those who supported the students were the rabbis. Some of them the leaders of the Agudas HaRabbanim. It was a tremendous dilemma. Because you want a yeshiva, you want a yeshiva. They knew a yeshiva. They went to Mir, they went to Slonim, they went to Voloshin. Voloshin, the greatest amount of American Rabbanim came out of Voloshin. They went to yeshiva. They went to Tells, who had a high school. But they recognized this is America. Ramaz, Rav Leventhal, Rav Rosenberg, Rav Yisrael Rosenberg. Americanized. They knew the reality. So now you have a problem that stares at you. To a certain degree, this quagmire continues until today with various outflows. No, you're going to bring in a foreign element into the yeshiva. How do you control it? How do you know what it will lead to? It's the same question we have today with the computer. You have a computer. I don't have any thing to censor my computer. I don't believe any of my children, grandchildren have.
I told you, I mentioned to you that this great uncle you mentioned, young Israel.
Right.
So he came to America. He worked with Rav Baruch Barer in
Europe.
He came to, so he goes to Yitzchak Elchanan. And then he got into Columbia at night.
Right.
Yeah, at night he went to, they heard he was going to Columbia. They threw him out of Yitzchak Elchanan.
Right. This becomes a question that occupies the history of yeshiva more or less until this very day. You had with Richard Joel, you had quite, I can give you endless examples. A simple example, you're going to run ultimately a college. No? If you're running a liberal arts college, you have to teach art. How many famous pictures do we have of ladies that are not clothed properly, okay? All right, I don't want to say they were nudes. Not clothed at all, but all right, not clothed at all. Fine, nudes. I mean, delicate question. You want to teach English literature? No, what is English literature? What's some of the Canterbury Tales? Schmutz. Batsheva's singer, I owe him an apology. He was very, in the 60s, Batsheva's singer. So they came out with one of his books in English, Jewish Publication Society. So Malk and I, remember JPS used to subscribe, you picked out 10 books, it cost next to nothing. So one of the books I got in the Rebbe's court, whatever it was called, is in my father's court, the book was so vulgar. So we thought the man is a sex pervert. I have to tell you, very unfortunately, 50, 60 years later, after seeing life, he was describing it like it was. Unfortunately, it's like it is. I think it's worse today than it was in his father's court in Poland. Do you understand what I'm saying? But these are real questions. You're going to teach science. Darwin. No, this question comes up all the time. I don't know what the question is. It had to be someone who created the first creation, and they're all right, take it further.
The age of the world.
The age of the world. The Rav said, you remember, Rav said in 1 second, what kind of question is this? You look at Adam and Eve. You come and look at them 1 minute after creation. How old are they? No. They were adults or babies. I don't know. When Michael Mishra doesn't say anything about the baby bottle and they were nursing and whatnot, it says they were created smart enough to give every animal a name. So the Rav said, no, how old are they? You understand? He said, I'm not troubled by these problems. He was very adamant. And when we were growing up, this was like the age of the world, Darwin. All right, but you can go on and on. These are real questions. You look at the computer, yes, it's true, you have all types of schmutz and idiocy and courses on a computer. But on the same time, I don't have to tell you what you have. You can turn the computer on now and for the next 40, 50 years, learn Torah, see Torah, go to YouTube and type in Lubavitcher Rebbe. You know how many Fabrenians you'll get? I mean, you can type in baseball, you get baseball games. I mean, it's unbelievable what's there. Wow, I'm on it. People showed me. I don't know who recorded me, who put me on. I mean, not on YU Torah, on YouTube, giving a share that had my Hesped for a Baron Lichtenstein. Not in YU Torah. They are on YU Torah. Now I know how many people have come to me. I don't know. It made an impression that I knew a Baron as a human being. Everyone else describing him was a Talmud. So I told the story. Well, I mean, I'm not giving my different time, but I told the story. Rav Baron was the last person alive who knew the starting lineup of the 1945 Chicago Cubs. And we used to talk about that team, Cavaretto, anyone baseball fancy, or Phil Cavaretto. He was the last one to die. He died in his mid-90s. An Italian. And a good family life, and he had his career here. And Rav Baron spent his formative years in Chicago. That was the last time they were in the World Series until, a year ago. So Rav Baron, you're a human being, a gentleman. Ubachata b'chayim. life is filled with choices. I can walk out of here, I can be a hold-up man, going back to yesterday's share. Or I can walk out of here and kiss every Jew who's coming out of the yard. It's choice. Ah, the Rabbanim already sensed what's happening. And right there in 1902, they make the statement, we are responsible for the yeshiva we have, Yeshivas Reb Pisco Hanan, and we have to see that it runs in a proper fashion. And it says, Harabonim yitnahagu b'sidrei habayit p'nimya u'b'sidrei halimudim al pivak ha-mafakeich ala yeshiva asher yashkir ki yaseidu l'mishmatam l'man yatzlichu b'limodam v'ki yitnahagu b'darkei ha-Torah mitzvot k'ra'ui l'mishacharin b'atei ulpana eila. We have to be the mafakhim, the supervisors. We have to see that the yeshiva runs in a proper fashion, teaches in a proper fashion, reaches out to those who come to it.
Yitzchak, No.
The high school's 1950. The high school actually begins January 1916. But everyone says 1915 because officially the merger took place and Rabbi Belkin became the Rosh Yeshiva and president. But to be technical, the high school began January 1916. It took time to arrange it, get accreditation, the state, etc. And the college begins September 1928. But gentlemen, do you hear a wind, something blowing in the wind behind this statement? What do you say? JTS. You see? JTS was organized 1887. JTS was organized to be an Orthodox institution. The reason they didn't use the word OJTS, which was suggested, was it would interfere with fundraising. And they wanted money from all Jews, which we can understand. No one today is going to turn down money because he worships in a Reformed temple or worships in a conservative temple. Right or wrong, the Lubavitcher Rebbe met with every Jew in the world, no matter. He said to one Balabas, a well-to-do, well-placed, he said now, the Balabas got all excited, said he's now joined the conservative temple. He left the Reform. So the Rebbe said to him, next year I want to hear that you went one step further. But JTS began, read the preamble. We spoke about this decades ago. I went through the preamble to their constitution in consonance with the written Torah, the oral Torah, Hebrew. It spells it out 100%. And already by 1902, there were winds of change. I cannot say that JTS at that point had changed radically, but they brought in Solomon Schacht in 1902, Mr. Schiff, Henry Schiff, I believe his name was. Mr. Schiff already said we need an enlightened orthodoxy in America. Schiff, Jacob Schiff. That's what I said. I think his name is Jacob Henry. Maybe I'm wrong with the middle name. But Jacob Schiff, Mr. Schiff, we need an enlightened orthodoxy. So you see, there was this fear already. We can't let anything go wrong with Reitz or any other yeshiva that will be established. We are the supervisors. We are responsible. Now this is quite a statement, and I want to tell you, they lived up to it, fought for it, and basically succeeded in being the supervisors until 1940. Then there's change, difficulty, struggle, infighting, but we'll get to that. It's not for now. But I would say for on to 40 years, they were the supervisors. Yitz got smicha from the yeshiva. Who signed your smicha? Rabbi Belkin and Rabbi Soloveitchik. No outsiders. Insiders. I have the same smicha, the same signatures. No. Dov, you have a long-lost cousin who got smicha in 1939. Who signed his smicha? Five signatures. Rabbi Leventhal, Rabbi Rosenberg, Ramaz already, I think, was gone, but he would have signed. Rabbi Soloveitchik, no, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, yes, not Moriah Rebbe, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, Rabbi Revel, Rabbi Aronovich, that was Shesmicha. Three in, three out. Insiders, outsiders, Mufakrim, exactly what they desire to do. Yosef, one step further. Not only the yeshiva, but they're concerned, you see, once again, the rabbis are out in the field. They're not making money. They're trying to make Jews. They see the problems in making Jews. The guy who owns real estate couldn't care less if you're a Mechal Shabbos, a Shaima Shabbos, if you're Irish, if you're Italian. He's renting apartments. He just wants to rent. But the rabbis were out there. They knew the difficulties. They knew that general studies were inevitable. My mother-in-law went to high school. She went to normal college, I think it was called, to be a teacher. The Jewish girls didn't yet go to regular colleges. But the winds were blowing. Their own children. Ah, if we're going to introduce secular studies, and they say chanuchitzim letalmidim lehishtalem bahem, and we understand that this is important. The students need secular studies. The students need high school. The students need degrees. But we have to supervise that the secular studies should be in consonance with our Torah. And look at their words. Al-Havad la-Hashkiach ba-Hashkachaya Teira. Be very careful. Laval yasu ha-Talmidim et ha-Yeshiva le-Prozda. La-Hadken et atzmam li-Kanes li-Achad mi-Batei ha-Megesh le-Linu de-Chol. V'tachlit ha-Mechavenet mi-Batim ke-Elu lo-Tavo le-Shlemut ha-Netzah. We know the Talmidim want to go on to college, but we have to see that the yeshiva is more just a preparation for college. That's not the product we want. We want someone who will come out of the yeshiva with shleimut, with dedication, with commitment to Torah, and then he can go on to college. And you see, this was troubling them already at that time. These problems come up again and again and again. When Reb Aaron Cutler visited America, you all know he didn't want to give his shiur in Reitz already. Talking about, I believe it was 37. Already at that time, the secular studies being taught there, happy courses. You mentioned Reb Baruch Ber Leibovich comes to America, very hesitant to give his shiur in yeshiva. Reb Elchanan Wasserman refuses. He mamash refused. You couldn't influence him. They asked, why are you so adamant? He produces a letter from Mr. Manashevitz, Hirsch Manashevitz, complaining that apikursus is being taught in the college. Secular material like Bialik being taught in the college. I have the letter, I reproduced the letter in Revel. Problems on and on. Modern times, courses in art, courses in literature, vulgarity. I had a course in English literature. 2 years, I think, I studied English literature. So I remember one teacher couldn't say a sentence without a curse word. That was part of the course, part of the atmosphere, part of the aura. One professor always maledicted Dr. Belkin. I have no idea. Kol hakavod to the yeshiva that they allowed these people freedom of expression. But you see, this problem lives on. I told you the incident with Professor Regis and Reb Heschel Schechter. I mean, I'm not a stranger to it. Professor Regis, with the Rambam, with the whole attitude. Again, I don't want to go into detail, Lona Imli, but you all have studied Torah. You know, there's a very big difference between the approach that comes across from the Rambam's writings towards sex and the Ramban and Nachmanides' writings towards sex. All right? Totally different approaches. Which approach do we have to take today? In my opinion, the Ramban. It's not just my opinion, the Stipler Rav. If you're familiar with that letter, the Stipler Rav wrote, absolutely telling off fellas in Chazon Ish Kollel in Bnei Brak who started shtick with their wives of super frum when it comes to sex. And he told them off, and they are reingesucked, wow, hit them hard. And he said, nowadays there's no room for chumris and frumkeit, etc. I don't want to spell it out, Lona Imli. But you have the yeshiva, the history. He spoke against the Rambam, has she shachta Rav Kriya? There was a Professor Zeitlin who went to Drapsi College. Rabbi Reuben went to Drapsi. Professor, what was it, Yoshua Zeitlin?
Solomon.
Shlomo Zeitlin. Yeah, right. Solomon Zeitlin. Professor Zeitlin taught at the yeshiva. Ultimately, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik said to Rabbi Revel, it's me or him. Plain and simple.
He had some very strange ideas.
No, let me say that.
About many things.
But yes, he was idiosyncratic. Which.
But everything was sourced. That is the amazing thing.
Yitzchak, I can give you more details, it's not for now. Many people with good minds go off the beaten path. They have to come up with a chiddush.
You know the whole history, professors, and why you were his students.
In our time, everyone was a product of Drapsi. But Reb Moshe said to Rabbi Revel, me or him, we come up with that. You understand? So these problems last until today. What's amazing, and they're always going to be with us. It's not simple. You want a college, you want a university, you want broadness. Look what happened here in Israel. How many of you saw the video of the dancing in Har Mor on Simchas Torah night? I think, what did I see? A million people hit it. That's unbelievable numbers. Suddenly you see hundreds and hundreds. This is in Har Choma. They just built a tremendous building there, and hundreds dancing, not one black hat. Everyone in a white shirt. They're overwhelmed. It's like everyone looks the same, except very different. This is black and this is white. How did Hamar begin? No, this is the split from Merkaz Harav. Rav Avram Shapiro never forgave them for the split, never forgave Rabbi Tau. Why did they split? Because Merkaz Harav agreed to have, as part of their official program, education. You get a degree. You finish the yeshiva, you take courses in education, you have a degree, you can teach. You're eligible for teaching. What? A yeshiva is going to have a course in education? We didn't have that in Voloshin. We didn't have that in Mir. We didn't have that in Slabodka. And Rav Tau, with a number of other rabbeim, walked away, organized a new school. Today, they're achveis three times the size of Merkaz Harav. My whole family, my brother's family, among the biggest supporters, the endless kids who went there.
Herzl College is part of the yeshiva.
Right. To them, that's happy courses. Herzl College should be part. And they teach Bible, and they teach it innovatively. All right. These are questions.
But that's one of the great things.
Yitzchak, we're not asking for your hashkafa or my hashkafa. We're only trying to show you historically that the Agudas HaRabbanim, they were sensitive already, 1902. Let me go one step further now and, wow.
And yet, you know, it seems, I mean, I'd be jumping ahead, but in 1902, Agudas HaRabbanim seemed a lot more liberal than the
British
before they closed up.
That we'll talk about. That's post-World War II.
They were like off the wall by then.
No. In your opinion, their opinion, we are off the wall, but it doesn't matter. That's Reb Aaron Cutler. Reb Aaron Cutler changed the Torah scene in America, and we all better off for worse, depending on the way you look at it. I'm only sitting here, in my opinion, I'm only sitting here because of Rabbi Aaron Kotler. Do you know what I'm saying?
No.
Whoever dreamt of the yeshiva having kollelim? When I graduated YU, there was not one kollel. The attitude was, either you know how to learn at the age of 23, or you'll be an amoritz all your life. But Lakewood started having kollelim and branching out. Remember, there's a kollel in Boston, Reb Leib Hyman. They had something in St. Louis. They had Philadelphia. Today YU has, you don't have, how many fingers do I need to count the kollelim? I think there are five. Yosef, how many? Five, I think so. If not five, four. It's the result of Rabbi Aaron Kotler, Baruch Hashem.
I never studied with Aaron Kotler, but I must tell you, I realized that what I knew in 19, when I was 23, was not sufficient.
Okay.
So I began on my own. Otherwise, I would have stayed where I was. If I didn't get saved since then,
I
would be in Abba's first class.
So you are quoting Aaron Rakefet. Smicha is a license to start learning.
Right.
That's what it amounts to. What I know today, no one taught me. And please. But I was taught how to learn.
18 years ago, I must say, at Shabbat Rodah, I started your principle 4:30 in the morning. Every morning for 18 years.
Kalakabam.
An hour study.
No, kala kabal. That's the best time to study. No one can bother you. But I have all the things going. Baruch Hashem. Let me continue 1 second. Baruch atodan melech alam shekol niyemit v'ram. Now I want to bring everything back to home. The next item, we're not going to finish it today, but let's start. We just had a big explosion. A guy named Rakefet went crazy because of an interview his classmate gave to Makor Rishon. I can mention the name when I spoke at the press conference. I didn't mention his name. Again, my opinion carries no weight. I have no one behind me to publicize. Rabbi is speaking. Makor Rishon, come, send a reporter. Don't think that Rabbi Riskin is the only student of Rav Soloveitchik. Here's a different point. But I can't win. We're an orphan here. An afterthought, but that's the reality. So Rabbi Riskin said about the homosexual issue, onus rachmani patre. I said what I said, I don't think that has any applicability. But I want to tell you what Rabbi Riskin said. And this was said 110, 20, 30 years ago. There was no observance of Shabbat in America. The few people who remained frum became heroes. You know that the Jewish Action a year ago or so had an article on families that remained frum. Few and far between. My classmate, the great Rabbi Dr. Professor Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, Dr. Grach, his most famous article, Rupture and Reconstruction. You're all familiar with it. You can't breathe there without knowing that article by heart. It's outstanding, outstanding. Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik said about we were walking and talking, and with Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, I was like, we could talk baseball, you know. But with him, I couldn't talk baseball. I don't know how much he knew baseball. The Rebbe, you could talk baseball in the 70s already. But Rabbi Aaron, I said to Rabbi Aaron, new Rebbe, take a look what my classmate, your nephew, wrote. And Rabbi Aaron, I'll quote him, he says, Chaimka, it's exactly like my brother. What made my brother unique? Anything Rabbi Yoshe Beer touched, he was Machadesh. Whatever. Gemara, Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, Medresh, Dashanut, Kabbalah, philosophy, Pashanut HaMikra, homiletics, right or wrong, anything the Rav touched. His mind was so innovative. Take a look how many Sfarim have come out quoting the Rav. Quoting the Rav, I'm talking not my work. My work is more quoting him on a historic level, but quoting him, Shas, Paiskim, homiletics, philosophy. Chaim is the same way. Anything he touches, he is so innovative. And that article, and but what does he say in the article? Rupture. There wasn't a frum person left in America. Wiped out. Now, I have to be honest with you, Professor Mark Steiner came to me, he was very upset, he says, honey, you got to write in response to Chaim, you know they were from people. I'm not anxious to write a response to Chaim, but they're both right. Percentage-wise, Chaim is absolutely right. 95, 97, 98% wiped out. All right, there was a small amount of people who remain from. A small amount. Mark's family, Mr. Weiss, that's his grandfather, they were Ungarische, came to America 120 years ago. Part of that family remained from. There's Bernard Horowitz, he was president of the Shul Avi Weiss's rabbi, or was rabbi. He's part of that family, they're cousins. Michael Horowitz, my classmate, is also a cousin. He already, when he was interviewed by the New York Times, very successful in Washington, he said, I'm a lapsed Orthodox Jew. A lapsed Orthodox Jew. He taka davens in an Orthodox synagogue, drives in from the suburbs in Washington on Shabbos. But they were both right. People said about America that Rabbanim, Gedolei Yisrael. There's nothing we can do. It's lost. If you don't work in America on Shabbos, you starve. Rabbanim said, Sakonet Nefashot. I'm talking in Europe. They attributed certain comments to the Chafetz Chaim. If you don't work, you starve. Melacha Shenit Tzricha L'Gufo. You're not working because you want to work. You're working because you want to survive. Others quoted Rabbi Riskin, Hon Rachmana Patre. I mean, which really has no applicability. You have a choice, but it's more halachic seichel to say you're going to stop. And I mean, I can give you endless examples. I'll give you an example that speaks for itself. I started learning Gemara. The Gemara is difficult. I'm an American kid. My father could barely read Hebrew. I'm an American kid. Father grew up in Harlem. Probably went to Cheder. There was no yeshiva yet. His mother probably would have sent him to Solanta. Solanta was organized in Harlem, but it was organized. My father was already 8, 9 years old, 10 years old already. Gemara, wow. So I lived in a big building, Washington Avenue, 180th, 2115 Washington, Bronx, front, back, tens and tens of apartments. In front of the building, there was a family. He was a Yudapeyash Talmud Chacham. He knew Gemara. I don't want to mention his last name, but his first name was Gabriel. Every Shabbos afternoon, he would come home from work, midday. He worked 5.5 days. My kiddush, have a seuda. I would go over and learn Gemara with him. And that was accepted. That was part for the course. Everyone talks about it. I saw it with my own eyes. Remember, I spoke about it, and Rabbi Lam was sitting here, Avram Lam, and acknowledged the minyanim, the 6:30 Shabbos morning. There was a 6 o'clock, 6:30, minyanim w'mah. Those were all people who went home and changed their clothes and went to work. You don't have to go further than Harry Fischel's biography, which is basically an autobiography. It was put together by Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein, his son-in-law. But Harry Fischel gave him the information, but Harry Fischel describes how he was starving. And one Shabbos he said, that's it, I can't go further, I have to eat, I need food. And he dressed up, went to the early minyan, came home, changed his clothes, and started to walk to work. Harry Fisher. And on East Broadway, he saw people going to shul, to the big minyan, the later minyan, and he saw elderly husbands, wives, men with beards, women with their hair covered, and he thought he saw his grandparents. And he turned back, he couldn't work. Harry Fisher, I'm not making it up. The man is telling his own story. This is Harry Fisher, what he became. But even Harry Fisher wanted to go to work. And see, this the Agudat HaRabbanim recognized is their biggest problem. If they don't bring order, demand, command, respect for Shabbos, it will be completely forgotten. And first of all, they go in to the Hashgacha. In America, Ish HaYashav Einov Yaseh. You all remember the chapter with Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, chief rabbi, brought from Europe, wine, dine. Oh, everyone, such great expectation. Within a few weeks, there's another chief rabbi, the Moskva Rav, Rabbi Vidovich, I believe the name was. So, who made you the chief rabbi, they asked him. The sign painter. It's America, it's not England. There's no conservative element with a small c. There's no tradition. Ish HaYashav Einov Yaseh. So right away, what about bread? What about wine? What about all the basics of Jewish life, meat? And here, the Agudat HaRabbanim, we must see to it that anything involved with the Heksha is involved with Shmirat Shabbat. And you today take for granted, what are you talking about? There were kosher butchers all over the Bronx that I can recall vividly. Who are Mechalalei Shabbos? The butcher shop was closed. Who knows how much you could trust them? All right, Mechalalei Shabbos. But all right, the Rabbanim insisted they have to be closed then. What do you do with kosher wine? Who produces kosher wine? What do you do with matzah? You can go on and on of production, distribution. What about Shabbat? And I want to tell you, this issue ultimately leads to one of the blackest, worst episodes in the history of the rabbinate in the 20th century. I'll allude to it, we won't do it in detail, but we'll come to it a long time from now. But it's very simple. After World War II, the Bartons, the family, the Klein family, Hungarians had the candy business in Hungary, knew how to make good candy. People who knew how to make good candy succeeded. Charlie from, someone you know from Baltimore, Eli Schlesberg. What's his friend? What business did he inherit from his parents? He was able to sell it. Fine candy, chocolates, treats, people. Anine Hatam. He's a fabulous individual, Eli. Real, this is a balabas on the highest level. Wow. Rani and Eli. Give credit to his wife. So, Bartons comes. Shomer Shabbos. Everything. Terrific. You wanted to buy Bartons in the 50s? You had to go to a special Bartons store. Closed on Shabbat. You know what an impression that made on 13th Avenue in Borough Park? 3/4 of the stores were open on Shabbat. My mother's second husband was president of the Shmirat Shabbat Society. They went from store to store pleading with them to close down. Vic, can you believe that today or not? Do you remember it or not?
No. Remember the Shabbos truck?
Yes. Ah, what we were talking about. This is so. Bartons, Shomer Shabbos. Anyone could franchise a store legally committed to being closed on Shabbat. All right. Barasini's came to the OU, and Barasini's also Jewish-owned, high-level chocolate. And they wanted a Heksha. Their factory was Shomer Shabbat. They wanted a Heksha. Bartons went crazy. How can you give them a hechsher? They have stores that are open. They franchise. They make no condition that you have to be Shomer Shabbat. And you should know the RCA backed down and refused to give Barasini's a hechsher.
Really?
Yitzchak, where are you living? This happened when you weren't rooting for the Red Sox. You didn't know about Ted Williams. And add this to the list. You back down.
You never had a hechsher?
The OU at this moment is the best hechsher in the world. It was starting its reputation, which today is in golden letters. They had some, but not the OU. They wanted a rival partners. The OU gave in to outside pressure. I would like to believe this could not happen today. My dear students, within half a year, three quarters of a year, after Barasini's went out on its own and got a secondary heksha, the Bartons came up with a psak among the Rabbanim quoted, Rabbaron Cutler. Once the candy leaves the factory, they are no longer responsible for Shabbat. They manufactured it, kosher, Shabbat, everything observed 100%. The minute you franchise out, Ish HaYashor Be'inav Yasen, that's al pi halacha. What's wrong with it? And Goyim is selling Barasini's on Shabbos, and Goyim is selling Bartons. And within the year, they were doing exactly what Barasini's was doing. And this is, to me, the black chapter in the OU-RCA history. But these problems of Shabbos haunt us until today. A manufacturer? Where do you draw the line? What do you do? Comes up in halachic literature as well. You have stocks in a company. Are you responsible for the Chilul Shabbos? Are you responsible for the bread or the noodles that the company is manufacturing on Pesach? But back in 1902, the question was very basic. Will there be a semblance of Shabbos on the American scene, or will it totally be eradicated? And the Agudas HaRabbanim is gearing up to do battle. First with Hashkacha, and then we'll see next week beyond. Yes, Mori.
Did Barasini then get OU at that point?
No, as I recall, they never got an OU. They already were offended, and they had a Hashkacha, and we ate Barasini's and Bartons. They had a good Hashkacha. It probably was an Agudas HaRabbanim rub. If you check out Hapades, you probably could see who gave the Hashkacha. You have to go back in time. This all happened in the mid-50s.
Right. How long did they last?
Barasini's, Bartons, and both of them are not around today.
They both shared opposite corners on Delancey Street.
On Delancey Street.
On the corner on
All right. Competition is fair, but let it be with the...
both corner stores.
With the OU. They're both out of business today. There is the name Barton, so inevitably has a copyright, so I think Pesach time, they do sell some stuff with the name Bartons, but it's not Bartons.
Wasn't the Rub involved in something about Bartons that...
No, the Rub was involved. What happened with the Rub... give me a minute to finish. I'll answer Yitzchak's question and finish. The virtual audience, bear with me, we're a little bit over time. For those of you that are on an hour and a half trip, you'll stop at the light a little longer. You know what Yitzchak is referring to. I've often spoken about it. I was there. Before Pesach, in the mid-50s, early 50s, the Rav used to give a Pesach talk in the yeshiva. For all the Talmidim, the Rav was young then and did a lot outside of the Tuesday and Wednesday Shiur. So here's the Rav. As I recall, it was in the Beis HaMedrash, not in Lampert Auditorium. And the Rav fielded some questions after giving Dashanut and the Seder. You know, I mean, I don't have to tell you the Rav on so much has been published in his name, and you still don't exhaust everything he had to say about the Haggadah. So the Rav was asked, Rebbe, what about the legume derivatives? Right? So the Rav said, no, we don't use it. We don't use it. And parceled up not just legumes, but mekitniyot. Mekitniyot is, for instance, for the sake of argument, vegetable shortening.
Peanut.
Right? Peanut oil is a shiler altogether, because peanuts may not be kitni. It's the Lubavitchers, the Chabadikim did use it, Pesach. But essentially vegetable oil, the corn oil, something like that, mezola. So the Rav parceled it in public. This probably happened on Tuesday. Tuesday it has to be, because Wednesday already went back to Boston. Thursday morning, Mr. Bartons was at yeshiva with a group of lawyers ready to sue the whole institution furious because the OU never asid made kidney up. It's a whole machlokes poskim. I can quote to you endless poskim who were matir. The Lithuanians were more machmir, but when you came across to Poland and parts of the other parts of East Europe, they were mekil. It's hard enough, the gezeira on kitniyot. No one knows really why we have such a gezeira. But mekitniyot, there was never a gezeira. It didn't exist. It's all made before Pesach. It's batul b'shishim, etc., etc. I've given many shurim on this. I mean, the real reason for the gezeira of kitniyot, in my opinion, is if you go out to the fields and you see where different grains are grown, the wind can blow seeds back and forth. And that was the chash, that they would bring in some chametzdik seeds into rice, let's say. There's a very easy solution in the army, when the army still saved rice on Pesach, which they don't do anymore. So the whole rabbinate was called up a week before Pesach. We used to clean the rice. I know how to clean the rice. If you bring me a white tablecloth, I'll show you exactly how. You pour out the rice and you move it down. Three different people are sitting there. Each one is looking. And if you see anything black, you pull it out. Anything that's not white. And then that rice, if you cook it before Pesach and freeze it, it's lemahadrin, because it's but anything there is batul b'shishim. But okay, that was the army. So mekitniyot already was cooked and frounced and pounced and threshed. It's certainly whatever is in there is batul b'shishim before Pesach. So Mr. Bartons, Mr. Klein, Stephen Klein with his brother were furious. You can't blame them. Anyway, with that Friday, there was an advertisement in the New York Times. I still remember seeing it with these two eyes. The Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations is very proud to announce its full confidence in the chocolate produced by the Bartons facility. Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik of Boston has also stated his full confidence in their products, and they may be used by all on the holiday of Passover. Okay? And signed, I think it was the OU. I don't think YU had to sign it. It was the OU who signed underneath. Rabbi Soloveitchik's name was mentioned for the first time in the New York Times in that ad. I need not tell you that 1 year later, no one was using kidney derivatives because of the Rub's sock, and Bartons had to change their ingredients in conformity. This question haunts us until today in the state of Israel. As you all know, it's a real problem because our own children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren intermarry, slowly inter-ethnicity marry. They're Israelis. They don't even know that they're Tunisians, that they're Moroccans. I have a half-Moroccan granddaughter-in-law, a genius of geniuses. Don't ask. I have a picture of her in army uniform, an officer in intelligence, with her hair covered down to here. I showed her to a Satma Chassid. He was ready to jump off the bridge. He couldn't deal with it. He sees the Frumkeit and he sees the Katsina. So who is it? She's an Israeli. Her father is Czechoslovakian. Her mother was my student in Michlala, the Israeli division, early 70s. Her grandfather, my Mechutin, is the Sfadik chief rabbi, or was the Sfadik chief rabbi of Or Akiva. You follow me? We're all becoming Israelis. The problem of legumes haunts us. I think in 100 years it'll be behind us, but right now we're living it. I have a middle-of-the-road position. In 69, I spoke with Chief Rabbi Unterman, and he told me in Israel, Dominicans, the Ashkenazim do use May Kitniyot, and I was Mateh Neder, and I continue until today, because the one product I can't get is margarine. That does not have, I don't even go into detail. I got Chief Rabbi of Haifa ready to get Talmud to use cottonseed oil to the covered of Talmud. I have to tell you, they were willing to change the whole production on a yearly basis to cottonseed oil. And the Eidei Haredit said, we will not accept it. So they said to spend $1 million to change the whole plant and everything. And the Eidei Haredit will not accept it. Ma'ori l'chachavim b'takantan. And they wouldn't go along with it. And I don't blame them. So that's what I paskin l'alach. I understand Reb Meir Lichtenstein paskins exactly as I do and gives the same reasons. I have more reasons, but this should suffice for now. My dear students, first of all, a great thank you for coming. Yosef, a great thank you for coming. Will you check for me if anyone else will show? I have other names for this class. What is...
Maybe Bechina's going on.
Bechina, right. All right. At least the medical doctor doesn't have to be slaughtered by a chicken. I am happy to see that. And I know just what I'm saying. I just want to thank you very much for coming. As we did what we did today, all right. You feel Natiro too? You feel the pulse? You see how fascinating Torah history can be. And your heart goes out to these Rabbanim. And you see some of it, They're very very intuitive. They're looking ahead. They're struggling, but they're looking ahead. So we spoke about the Yiddish again. We spoke about extension education. Spoke about REITs. Spoke about the secular program. And we started talking about Shabbos. As I mentioned, Wednesday, I will give a talk on Mr. Mendel Gottesman. If anyone is awake at 8 o'clock and cares to join us, you are welcome.
Where is this talk?
Right here in this room. It's before any classes. I have access to the room.
Wednesday?
Why did you wait all this time to share it with us? Because I just, Yomo this morning just gave me the time. We had agreed on Wednesday, but it will be 8 o'clock.
Will this be on the YU?
Yeah. Ultimately, I'll see to it. Absolutely. It will go on yutorah.org. Okay, the problem that I'm haunted by is December 3rd, I stop all teaching, and I have an obligation to be Makir Toiva to the people who influenced me, and I want to talk about them. But I'm going to be consecutive. In other words, I'm going to begin on a Sunday, Sunday, Monday, Sunday, Monday. I hope I can finish it in 4 Shavuot. I hope I can. I'm not... you're going to see me walk in with a book of hundreds of pages that I'm not doing their lives. I'm doing just my concept, what I gained from them, how they influenced me. So I'm just mentioning that because some of you have no problem. You hear both lectures. Some of you only hear one. So it presents us a bit of a problem. But okay, we can overcome it with yutorah.org, or maybe you're free to come both days, those 2 weeks. The five names, I have to tell you, after class last week, Yitzchak guessed the five, 3 out of the 5. So he didn't guess the first two. I begin in order, as I will do it. Reb Chenich Fishman, Shanghai. Reb Meir Kahana, Bnei Akiva. Reb Aaron Cutler, Lakewood. Reb Yaakov Moshe Cohen Lesson, the Mashgiach of the Yeshiva. Moi Rebbe Hamufak, Rebbe Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. Those are the 5 people I want to speak about. And now a number of freebies. I have to say, it's interesting what you see in life. this is an old issue of Bamishpacha, and I can't subscribe to it. I like it. It has interesting articles. My wife won't let it into the house because of their apikorsus. They don't have pictures of women, which goes against the Torah. My Torah says, Al Kenya Zobisha, the Vivimo. It talks about Sarah and Avraham. It talks about Rivka and Yitzchak. I don't have to tell you. Sarah talks about Rachel, Leah, the Shvachot. Very bad that they don't have pictures of women. We have more sex crimes than ever in our Torah world. As I said before, I owe Bathsheba Singer an apology. But a nice article here. A day in the life of Yerachmiel Rattenberger. He was a student in the Kollel. He is the chaplain in the Jewish community. He is the Jewish community liaison at the Calvary Hospital in the Bronx. It's a hospice. And it's an interesting article, not easy reading because it deals with death. But he was right here in this call. I believe his brother was here as well. His father got smicha with me. If anyone wants, this is an older copy of Hamayan. Some very, very interesting articles in it, as you generally have in Mayan. Mayan is a continuation. It was originally Poli Agudat Yisrael, and now Shalavim publishes it. It's a synthesis between Torah and Derech Eretz, between Talmud Torah and classic scholarship. Yitz, why don't you take this for Michael Miller? He will appreciate it. Here I have to tell you, I had a great hanar. This is from Mariv. I believe it's, let's just see if it's a special issue or just their magazine section. Anyway, this is Simchas Torah. I knew it was a special. This is the Mariv Simchas Torah. Gentlemen, I actually met this individual. Every word is true. This is a black rapper who had trouble with the law. You gotta read that. And then a friend of his was killed. There was a whole murder investigation. And at a certain point, he looked for spirituality and concluded Torah has it all. And there he is. That's exactly. He was living in Rehavia. Many times he davened mincha in Yad Tamar. Today, I believe he's moved to the center of town, so he's got endless shuls there where to daven. If anyone's interested in the article, be my guest. It's a beautiful, beautiful article. This is what I gave out yesterday. I still have two more copies. An article that appeared in Jerusalem Post by a conservative female rabbi who teaches at the Schechter Institute. Why we have to have a mechitzah at the Kotel, and I was very happy to see. I talk normal. She's quoting many things I said in class. Beautiful, beautiful article. Kol HaKavod. These are two articles, I don't know if this is right, then the Kushner's going to shul on Sukkot. And, beautiful, there is Jared with the lulav, the etro, the children, very, very beautiful article. I just wonder, you know, if when you're in the public limelight, you got to live with it. Here are the kids, here, going to shul, take a look with scooters. Okay, this is the sixth, but now this is Chabad material. This is very, very moving. I couldn't believe it. You will remember the tragedy, or those of you that are my age or near my age, of in 1956, Kfar Chabad, the Fedayin came in and killed children, remember? And they wanted to give up Kfar Chabad, and the Rebbe gave them encouragement to remain. And he sent over 12 shluchim to strengthen Kfar Chabad. Can you believe it? This is a reunion today of the 12 shluchim. I couldn't believe it. They're all alive. This is what they looked like then. This is what they look like now. And remember, it was a school for printing, for dfus, that they came in and killed. Oh, God, I remember in America the impact. This is from the sixth Rebbe, commenting on Mindel. Rabbi Mindel was teaching Torah, and the kids were asking questions. This is in Manhattan. And the sixth Rebbe always ask him, what did the kids ask you? And here the kids ask, what does the Torah mean when it says, it was good? What do you mean it was good? Everything God makes is good. How could it not be good? Why did God make it if it wouldn't be good? And the sixth Rebbe gave it to his son-in-law, the Ramash, Reb Menachem Mendel, to answer. And this is Reb Menachem Mendel's answer to the kids in English translation. Very, very fascinating. Ach, he's a great individual. These are stories of Chabadnikim about their in relationship with the Rebbe. And again, unbelievable. Avram Infeld, he's done great things in Israel. Professor Reuven Feuerstein, the children born with challenged children, what he has done. He's no longer alive, but what this man has accomplished. One Prosper Israel, Rabbi Leibel Posner. Okay, and with that, I believe I've given out. If you want, Morty's, the Shmuel Landau, what they gave out. All right, one last word. Can I hold you another minute? Something I said in class, a very dominant, traumatic moment in my life was the Treif Wine incident. So do you know what the Treif Wine I'm talking about? I write about it in Washington. Charlie Liebman wrote about it in the 60s in Judaism. And the story is very simple. I'm my first rabbinate, my first week in Ballykinder, Pennsylvania, Lower Merion Synagogue. Today, Lower Merion, one of the important synagogues in America. Then a little house with a small minion and striving very hard to be accepted. And as Charlie says, if you walked in with a pen in your pocket on Shabbos, no one would say a word. But if your tzitzis were sticking out, they'd tell you it's not nice. You walk with your tzitzit out. It's not modern, not up to date. You people who walk in, they won't want to come back to the shul. So here I am, and the president of the shul, the Yeshiva College graduate, well-to-do, well-placed, obviously don't want to mention the name. It makes a kiddush in my honor. And after I make Kiddush on the wine we had then, there was no much, very Gnelis Lange, Shapiro. Until today, I love sweet wine. I don't have a taste. I see people spend 100 shekel on a bottle of wine and they're smelling it and they're up in heaven. And give me a simple Concord wine, what I grew up on, and I'm in heaven. So what he says to me, Rabbi, turn away. This is not for you. And from underneath, he lips out a bottle of French wine, and he starts giving it out. And I say to him, with a gut reaction, Leon, that's not kosher. And YU gets a letter that week, get that moron Rothkopf out of here, he embarrassed the president. Now, I often said I don't have a solution. I've often spoken about this I often spoke past tense with the late Vic Geller, who placed me there. And we don't have a solution. What can I do? It was in public. It wasn't in private. It wasn't like I could overlook it and talk with them privately. Here it's in public. 40, 50 people are looking. Their eyes are upon me. And he takes this Treif wine. Okay. And this little incident starts a year that becomes a haunted house for me. Now, I've often said I have no solutions, so one of the people listening used to come to Shir for many years. He's older today. I regret that he doesn't come. Jack. So Jack left me a message on my phone. Rebbe, years ago you said that what you should have done was not said anything and given lectures on kashrut and lead him to wine and ultimately explain to them why the wine is not kosher. Yeah, maybe I did say that, but it's not really a solution either, because I had to react on the spur of the moment. You understand that the people, this is treif, it's not kosher. The rabbi is standing there. So with all due respects, I know what Jack is saying. Jack is quoting me, quoting the Rav. The Rav once said to us as follows, that the only way you're going to produce people who are going to be Shomer Torah mitzvah is you have to explain to them what they're doing. You can't do it out of rote, out of habit. You have to give shiurim. And he said, I'll give you an example. When I came to the rabbinate, remember I had a terrible fight over duchening on Shabbos. I write about this in my two volumes on the Rav. The Rav came into the shul, it was Shabbos Yontif, and the Rav said, you have to duchen. They looked at the Rav, what are you, the Bistam is Shugana? Tuchnin of Shabbos, das is Chilul Shabbos. They gave the Rav a whole argument. You machal Shabbos if you duchen. And the Rav fought with them after duchen, and after Shabbos they met and voted that Rabbi Soloveitchik is never to enter the shul again. Finished. That, you know, it's Rav of a number of shuls, chief rabbi of Boston. So the Rav said, I made a bad mistake. Life taught me what I should have done is not responded, and I should have given a series of lectures and explained what duchening is and why you have to duchen and when you have to duchen and what the minhagim are and why people think you shouldn't duchen on Shabbos. It's because we don't duchen all year on Shabbos because we're not sharui besimcha. But on Yom Tov falling on Shabbos, we certainly are sharui besimcha. We certainly have to duchen. And the Rav said, the rabbi came to me and he said, Rebbe, I have a big problem. The balabatim are always in a rush to end Shabbos. I told them, give a number of lectures on Shkia, Yom, Chol, when Shabbos begins, what Tosfos Shabbos is. And if you'll give those lectures, they won't be in a rush to end Shabbos before this month. And the rabbi came to me a few months later, Rabbi Soloveitchik, you were absolutely right. I gave those lectures and solved the problem. So the same thing with wine. But halacha l'maisa, the quagmire remains. What do you do on the spur of it? My dear students, I want to wish you all a wonderful week. It should be Besora Tova. I hope no one gets caught. Now we have the Nechim, a learning from the Haredim. The Haredim learned from the Nechim. If you know what's going on today already, mess. It's and it harms innocent people. This is what's so terrible. So it should be a wonderful week, and we should just have Besora Tova from here to Iran. And Be'ezrat Hashem will pick up where we left off next week. Das v'danya. Thank you.